Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
You know, there used to be only two ways to meet for business, over the phone or in person. Now there's a better way. Use GoToMeeting to meet online. With GoToMeeting, everyone sees your computer desktop on their computer screen. So you get the best of both worlds. It's like meeting in person, but without wasting time and money traveling. And your conference calls will be more effective. The best part is that you can actually try it for free. That's right, GoToMeeting is free right now for 30 days. For this special offer, you must visit www.gotomeeting.com/podcasts. That's gotomeeting.com/podcasts for a free trial.
Hello and welcome. This is Andrew Horowitz, and this is the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Welcome aboard to episode number 119. Thanks for joining me today. We have a special guest. It's going to be Jim Rogers that's coming on board. You know him, the investment biker, worked with George Soros on the Quantum Fund, lives in Singapore. And I thought what we'd do today is spend a little time on the international markets, prepping you up for this discussion with Jim Rogers, and really getting into some of the detail of the Asian markets and the global environment right now. And then we could spend some time talking with him about what he thinks and what he sees for the future. Remember, he's a big commodities guy. He really enjoys the Asian markets, and I think prefers the Asian currencies over the dollar somewhat, from what I've seen and what I've read of him. And I thought we would get into that as well. But what I thought we'd do right now is spend a little time talking about some of the Asian markets. And boy, have they been on fire. As a matter of fact, if you look at the China market, the China market, the Shenzhen, it's up 100% year-to-date. Now, it's two of those, one's an A and a B, but anywhere from 82 to 100%, depending on which one of those you choose. We've seen the Straits Times, which is, of course, Singapore, of 41% for the year. And, I mean, when you look down this list, even the Hang Seng up 37%. We're looking at the Stock Exchange of Thailand, up 36%. Jakarta is up 59% year-to-date. Sri Lanka up 65%. And Ho Chi Minh City up only 37 cents. We're going to 37%. We'll cry for them. But, you know, of course, they've had a really rough time through 2007 and 2008. They were a little bit behind us, behind the U.S. when it came to the markets really, you know, selling off dramatically. But what I also wanted to talk to you about, more important than just the returns, let's take a look at what's going on in terms of these countries, their GDP, their unemployment rate, etc. So I took a few things. Japan, first of all, the GDP is year over year down 8.8%. They have a GDP, a total GDP of about $4.3 trillion, the biggest of all the Asian countries. Although recently, supposedly, China is going to start eclipsing them. The China market has a 7.9% year over year GDP growth, whereas India has a 5.8%. And again, in terms of size, you really start scaling down very dramatically when you get past Japan. China, $3.2 trillion. India, $1.1 trillion. When you get down to Thailand, you're at $245 billion. Singapore, $161 billion. Year over year, Singapore is down 3.7%, but they have a surplus. They have a surplus of exports, essentially, of 12% in Singapore as compared to their GDP. So it's the divisor, if you will. And, you know, they have an unemployment rate of only 3.2%, where Japan only has 5.2%, China 4.3%, India 7.3%, and perhaps the biggest in the region is Indonesia with 8.1% overall unemployment. But I got some other statistics I thought were interesting. Let's compare that now to the United States. So the United States is the number one GDP in the world with $13 trillion GDP. Canada is only at $1.3 trillion only. The Eurozone is at $12 trillion. The entire Eurozone is at $12 trillion. And supposedly our GDP year over year is going to be about 2.5% in the negative. We have a deficit of 7.8%. The Eurozone is pretty much flat. UK is a negative 2.6. And again, just looking at that in, you know, relatively, when we look at the surplus to deficit, Japan is a negative 3.8. Again, we're at negative 7.8. And there's really no significant year-over-year growth. The worst country is probably Mexico right now when it comes to this region. But here's what's interesting, the jobless rate. Listen to this. We're at 9.5% in the United States. Canada's 8.6. Brazil is at 8.1. Eurozone's at 9.5 as well. But when you compare that to most, if not all, of the entire Asian continent, I mean, we're talking about fours, fives, sixes, maybe some sevens in there. Kind of a different animal, different situation going on in Asia. And maybe that's some of the reason why they're so easily able to really move out of this in such a dramatic fashion. They're not dragged down by this massive unemployment. You know, they're a different type of place to be, place to work. And we'll see if that really holds out. And like I said, we're going to ask a lot of questions from the guru in this area, who is Jim Rogers, and we're going to get to him right in a second. I just want to mention to you that some people did ask me again and thank me. I got some emails, so I'm going to tell you once more. If you want to check out the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy, it's a virtual tour of how we manage money. Audio, visual, 14 minutes. I take you through it. Go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. We'll put a link right in the website notes in there for you. It's on the right-hand side. It says this little blue kind of rectangular thing that says, a hedge fund without a hedge fund. Go check that out. Click it and spend some time there. I think you'll really enjoy it. And when we get back, we're going to be talking with Jim Rogers, and I think you'll enjoy that. I know I've been looking forward to this for some time. And by the way, just to let you know, he's in Singapore. This is a very late night for me on the podcast, so I hope you enjoy it. Stick around. We'll be right back on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And we are back on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And as I told you, we're with Jim Rogers, all the way in Singapore. Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm fine. Delighted to be here.
Thanks. So I thought we'd start out. I told you that we had a discussion with my listeners a little bit about the global situation, the kind of unbalanced situation right now where we see not only China, but the entire Asian region, almost, as I see it, picking up the rest of the world. Is that how you see it?
Well, I would hardly say that Asia, or China especially, can pick up the rest of the world. The Chinese economy is one-tenth the size of the European and American economies combined, it is. So, even if they boom, it's going to take a lot more than that. India and China alone are tiny economically compared to the rest of the world. But things are better in Asia. Having said that, let me quickly say things are better in Asia than they are in the West. The largest creditor nations in the world are all in Asia now. China, Japan, Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore. I mean, the money's out here now, whether we like it or not.
Yeah, it is quite astonishing. And, now the talk of, changing the U.S. currency. I mean, is that a lot of this flap right now, or is that just is something that really you think is going to occur?
The slack in the currency.
In other words, there's a discussion about having changing the world reserve currency, and we've been hearing it from the BRIC countries in particular. Is that something that's going to really happen?
Well, there's no question that the world has a problem with its reserve currency, i.e., the U.S. dollar. It is a terribly, terribly flawed currency to be using as the world's medium of exchange. The same thing happened to the pound sterling once upon a time, and it lost its status. I mean, the same thing has happened to every currency in history which the world has used at one time or another. Will it happen anytime soon? I don't think so, but the world is moving away, trying to figure out a way to move away from the dollar. Our enemies, America's enemies, are already stopping the use of the dollar, Iran, Venezuela, people like that. Many of our friends are starting to question the future of the U.S. dollar, so the U.S. dollar's days are numbered as the reserve currency, but having said the days are numbered, I don't expect any problem. I don't think that to happen. Expect that to happen this year.
Right.
But it is happening over time, just as happened with the pound sterling.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think that there's a lot of concern about, number one, what the U.S. government is spending to try to prop up the whole banks and all that, but then also the relationship with many of the commodities. I mean, do you think that's a big issue and a concern, the relationship of the dollar to oil and to many of the commodities out there? Because that seems to be a big problem.
Well, given that most of these commodities trade in the U.S. dollar, mm-hmm. that will cause transition problems if and when the world moves away from the dollar. But remember, 100 years ago, all these commodities traded in the pound sterling.
Right.
It doesn't anymore. The world has somehow or another survived, and we've all moved forward. I'm sure there were people who went bankrupt during the transition. There were also people who made fortunes during the transition.
Yeah.
That will happen again this time.
So one of the things that I think that I understand is that you're living in Singapore out of choice. You like that, love that country, my understanding is. And, yes. You know, you could live anywhere in the world. You know, that's your choice right now. It has a pretty, I mean, solid-looking foundation. I mean, we're talking about a 12.5% surplus to GDP on overall. It has a small economy, what, about $161 billion. Low unemployment rate, which is great. You know, CPI is low right now. GDP is kind of getting a little hurt here. But if my understanding is that in Asia, when you look out at that, and I think, you know, maybe this is something you can help me with, South Korea, Singapore, maybe Taiwan, possibly Taiwan, maybe not so much, and Thailand to a degree, but not so much China is some of the things that you like. Is that correct?
Well, as I said before, the major creditor nations in the world are now in Asia. This is where the assets are. Throughout history, you have seen people move in the center of influence and power moving to where the money is. You have never heard any time in history where people said, you see all those debtors over there? Let's go over there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people have always said, you see, that's where the money is. Let's go where the money is. Singapore has, if you look over the past 50 years, or Japan was the greatest success story of the last 50 years. Singapore was the greatest success story in the world of the past 40 years. China probably of the past 30 years. So lots of great things are happening in Asia. We picked Singapore for a variety of reasons. The many reasons go into where you wind up living, as you well know. I mean, we weren't transferred here or anything. We came here because we wanted to, mainly because we want my children to grow up speaking Chinese and understanding Asia. Asia is going to be extremely important in their lifetimes. These little girls were born in 2003 and in 2008, so I'm making an investment in their future, not so much in mine as in their future. This is where the money is, and this is where the action will be, like it or not.
I hear you. Listen, I've been over there a few times, and I think it's a fabulous area. But let me ask you about Japan. I'm stumped on Japan. Japan looks like an economy no different than maybe, I don't know, England in a way. But yet they have the proximity to Asia, so that it helps them, I guess. But, you know, when you look at the P/E ratios, and you look at the earnings, and you look at the potential, and you look at the aging, aging economy, you look at their exports. I mean, is Japan a viable economy any longer?
Well, Japan does have some serious, serious problems. It may be comparable to England. Well, not comparable to England 100 years ago, but it certainly has serious problems. They've got a demographic problem, probably the worst in the world. They, for the first time in their recorded history, they have a declining population, and the birth rate is such that there won't be any Japanese in 100 years unless something happens. You combine that with staggering internal debt. I mean, perhaps the highest internal debt of any country in the world. And I just don't know what's going to happen 20 years from now in Japan. I own the currency at the moment. I own a few Japanese shares, but they do have the advantage that they're near Asia and that their largest trading partner is now Asia as a whole, and specifically China, plus the other Asian countries. So that's helping them. I mean, Canada became a very, very successful country because it had a rich neighbor and was at the right place.
Right.
Well, Japan's going to benefit to some extent from that, but overall, I mean, I can't imagine I'll have any money in Japan 5 or 10 years from now unless they do something about the staggering internal debt problem and the demographic problem. They're the second largest creditor nation in the world internationally, but domestically they just have unbelievable debt, even worse than the U.S., believe it or not.
Yeah, I haven't been able to bring myself to invest in Japan, I'll tell you. You know, and I'm not, obviously, they're beaten down, they have the good trading partners and all that. But everything I see across the board, it just doesn't look like a healthy place to put money.
Well, as I say, I've got some money in the currency and the reason, by the way, just so you know, is they passed a law recently giving incentives for people to bring money back into Japan, the Japanese to bring their money back into Japan.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it'll work or not, but America did that a few years ago, as you may remember, and there were huge amounts of money came back into the U.S. on a temporary basis anyway. So that's why I own the yen, and they are a huge creditor nation as well.
So
there are various reasons that I have it. But again, I want to emphasize, I'm not going to have money in Japan in a few years from now unless something dramatic changes.
Right. So looking back across the across the world on the other side here. What is your, you know, opinion generally of the United States? I mean, you know, with our banking issues, which is obviously the worst in the world, you know, with our government spending more than any other country to backstop all this, you know, what is it looking like? Actually, two questions, the United States and then the whole Eurozone.
Well, the U.S. is the largest debtor nation now in the history of the world. It grieves me to say that since I'm an American citizen and, mm-hmm. and an American taxpayer and quite fond of the U.S., but we have to deal with facts, and the situation is getting worse. The federal government has probably quadrupled, quintupled, sextupled its debt here in just the last year or two alone. Nobody really knows because they took on such gigantic obligations. Now, this has never been a good thing for a country, especially to have this much debt this fast. So right now, the things are looking a little better because they've pumped huge amounts of money into the U.S. economy. And into the U.S. financial system. Well, that always helps for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But remember, the guys who get the money think things are much better, but it ultimately has got to come from somewhere. You either have to tax somebody or borrow it from somebody or print it. And ultimately, it leads to more problems down the road. Always has, anyway.
Yeah, I think we're doing all three right now, as a matter of fact. We're doing all three of those.
No, I know we are. And it scares me to death. What's equally terrifying is that the people who got us into this problem are the people that they're now saying, okay, you solved the problem. I mean, Geithner and Bernanke and Summers, these are the guys who caused the problem.
Yeah.
And yet somehow another Mr. Obama, just obviously doesn't know what he's doing. The idea that you take the people who caused the problem and who didn't understand that they were causing a problem and then say, now you fix it, is mind-boggling.
What's interesting is about Larry Summers, he seems to be the only one that talks at all anything about anything even remotely negative about the economy in the future. Everybody else is talking about a peachy green and a great story, where Larry Summers, I don't know what the differential is there. You know, talking about, you know, very limited growth potential, very slow recovery, very, you know, really, really trying to keep down expectations. I find that really interesting.
Well, that's because he's a politician now. You know, they all know that if you don't build expectations, then things come in better than you thought, then people say, oh, things are okay.
Yeah.
Things are better. They're trying to manage expectations. This is an old political trick that's been going on that politicians learned long ago.
Yeah. So one of the things I heard you talk about was the dollar and the dollar sliding and the potential for, I think you were talking a little bit tongue-in-cheek here, but the Dow to go to 40,000, and then, of course, Dow is not worth anything because the dollar is not worth anything. Do you believe that the dollar is, I mean, I've talked to a lot of people, you know, the dollar is going to be just obliterated long-term?
Well, it you look back at history, again, this is not any kind of political statement. Just look at it. What's happened throughout history, whenever a country's gotten itself into this kind of situation, it's always caused huge problems in the currency. I mean, the pound sterling went down over 90% from the top to bottom. I mean, that's over a long, long, long period of time. But still, it's down a great deal. It happened to the Spanish peseta, which was a great currency once for the world. The Dutch guilder, all these currencies have lost huge amounts of their worth, and that's going to happen with the U.S. dollar as well. Now, if that happens, of course, the prices of everything will go through the roof. Why can't the Dow Jones go to 40,000? I mean, I'm not suggesting it's going to happen anytime soon. Right. It wasn't tongue-in-cheek so much, just saying, gosh, if and when this does happen, the prices of all stocks will go through the roof, but it will be in worthless currency.
Yeah, we saw that with Zimbabwe. Let me finish up with this discussion. You know, I know you have, I think recently you talked about natural gas being a, you know, possibly a good play. But in terms of commodities, because this is something that you really know about, you know, what are we looking like on the side of commodities? I mean, is oil potentially going back up to some ridiculous number? And I have my reservations about that, but, you know, okay. This cap and trade issue, I don't even know where they come up with this ridiculous notion that they can, you know, really put the screws to companies like they're going to do with this. But nonetheless, you know, with all the commodities out there, where's the real play here?
Well, if I knew the answer to that, I'd be rich. We all would be rich. I wish it was that simple. As far as I'm concerned, all commodities are the place to be. I mean, the fundamentals of most of the world economy are not getting better, as we've discussed already, but the fundamentals for commodities are improving. Many farmers cannot get loans for fertilizer right now. Nobody can get a loan to open a mine. So you have a supply of nearly all commodities continuing to decline at a time when governments around the world are printing huge amounts of money. So whether the economy gets better or not, I'd rather be in commodities than anything else. Which ones are best? I I have no idea. I'm the world's worst market timer. I own them all.
Right.
I bought more agricultural recently. I'm keen on agriculture because the inventories are so unbelievably low and the prices are so low on a historic basis. Natural gas, I'd rather own than oil, but I own them both just because natural gas is down so much on a historic basis. The world's known reserves of oil are declining. There may be huge amounts of oil out there somewhere, but we don't know where it is. If it's there, and if you know, you should tell us,
mm-hmm.
so we can invest in it too.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But there's no question that at present rates of consumption, the world won't have any oil in 25 years, say. Any oil at any price, unless something happens very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd rather be in commodities than anything.
Right. And even with, you talk about the agricultures. I mean, you know, wheat, we've seen a ridiculous supply of lately. But you're saying still, comparatively, it's not that bad off most of these commodities and the prices are good. What about, I mean, these you know, we're seeing conversations with these potash. Is that in that whole genre as well?
Well, with potash, yes, that's certainly a commodity. There's no futures market or anything. It's
right.
used for fertilizer.
Right,
yes.
Right.
And if the price of agricultural products goes higher, then obviously somebody's going to make a lot of money with fertilizer if the farmers can afford it.
Right.
The problem is they can't afford it now.
Right.
There might be a transition. I'm not really current on potash, so I don't know. You say that there's a lot of supply of agriculture recently. Well, maybe in the U.S., but not in the world.
Yeah.
I mean, the inventories of agricultural products are the lowest they've been in decades. So you may have some oversupply here and some oversupply there.
Right.
But worldwide, and that's ultimately what determines the price of anything, the supplies are dangerously low. And if we start having weather problems, prices can just go to unbelievable levels.
Yep. So let me close with this. I know you've written a lot of different books, but the latest book that you wrote was much different than the other ones that you've written, I believe. It was a book, the title was For My Children, I think it was.
Gift to My Children.
Gift to My Children. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, you know, I've had a few failures in my life and a few successes in my life. So I've got two little children. I came to parenthood late. I didn't have a child until I was 60 years old. I was always very skeptical. In fact, I was anti-children.
Evil.
I used to feel sorry for people. I felt sorry for people that had children.
I understand.
First of all, I want you to know I was totally, unbelievably wrong about it.
Right, yeah. Admit this, right? Once you had the kid, like your entire life changed in a blink of an eye, didn't it?
It did, but people used to say that. I said, you poor sap. I thought they meant it changed it for the worse.
Right.
I didn't know they meant it changed it for the better, for goodness sake.
Yeah, I'm with you.
So, no, it certainly changed everything completely, and it's been a joy every day for the past 6 years. And it's changed. So I figured I better start writing some of these things down for my children because I learned a lot, and I wanted them to understand a lot about, you know, as I say, from my experience, my failures, my successes, to help them. And the next thing you know, I had a book.
Wow.
And I'm sure I'll continue to expand the book as well. It's a short little thing. You can read it in no time. It's some of my failures, some of my successes and excesses. And I wish people had told me some of these things long ago.
Yeah, well, and then eventually you're going to have the next set of beautiful grandchildren. You can write a book like For My Grandchildren, A Gift to My
Grandchildren. Well, I hope it goes to all of them. I mean, the book is written, hopefully, so that they can give it to their grandchildren and their grandchildren. The lessons in this book are eternal, at least I suspect they are.
That's great. Well, we'll put a link on that. Jim Raj, I really, really appreciate you taking some time this morning / this evening to spend time with us here on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. I encourage all my listeners to check out your books and to spend some time getting to know you more. I really thank you for all that you've done over the years to help people understand more about investments and the economies, commodities, and everything that you do. It's really very much appreciated by all of us around here.
Great. Thank you.
Okay.
My pleasure. Let's do it again sometime.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Jim. Bye-bye. Well, that was pretty cool. That was a lot of fun, actually. Jim Rogers, a really good guy, and I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with him. This is a legend in the investing world, and if you don't know about him, check out, just go to Wikipedia somewhere. Just learn about this guy. We have some links on our site at thedisciplinedinvestor.com so you can check out all about who he is, his books and all that. So go to the show notes for this episode. I wanted to also talk about a few things. I want to talk about what's happened in the last week or so. We started to see some signs that there is definitely stabilization in the housing market. That was really well received. It also seems that this big rally that we saw back on Thursday happened because we saw the incredible, the incredible ability of Congress just to take a measure like the healthcare measure and look at it, spit it out, look at it again, turn it around, rewrite it. And now all of a sudden there was some kind of inference that this may not actually happen. And that's when we saw the markets really rock on Thursday. But then what was interesting is it was really moving very well before that when we saw decent housing numbers. Of course, the unemployment numbers were pretty awful. Even though they're under 600,000, they're still pretty awful. Let's be honest about that. But what's interesting is we saw a couple of things come out this week that were, again, more to the positive in terms of the economics. Earnings came out. And I want to talk to you specifically about Caterpillar's earnings. That didn't look good at all. I mean, what was going on with that earnings? I mean, revenues were awful, and the outlook was pretty ugly. And even though they said that China was looking great, they only have about 11% overall revenue from China. So what does that really do for them? You know, one of the stocks we own is Ritchie Brothers, RBA. And the reason why we own that is simple. They do auctions for large machinery and things like Caterpillars and Deers. And if you were a construction manager, if you were someone who was in charge of the bidding, if you were someone who was in charge of building a gigantic new highway, and you knew that you had money coming in, but you know what? You had to spend it wisely. Would you go out and buy yourself a brand new Caterpillar or Deer, or would you go and maybe to the auction and would you go buy those? That's why we own Ritchie Brothers. And if you need to look at that, RBA is the symbol. I think that's a really interesting play right there. Caterpillar seems overdone. As a matter of fact, Frank Curzio and I teamed up. We wrote a little bit about that on the site. There's a little commentary about my thoughts and our thoughts on the Caterpillar earnings. So if you want to see that, there's some interesting charts that also, we put some fundamental charts together that I think you'll find very interesting. But, you know, what we also saw throughout the week was the continuation of earnings beats, but revenues misses continually. McDonald's got slammed. We saw some great things happen in the mining area. Solar did really well. We talked about solar a few weeks ago with John Najarian. Actually, we talked about it with Dr. J, John Najarian. And I think what's also interesting, if you look at some of the banks, what happened last week or last 2 weeks, I mean, they came out with earnings that looked just remarkable, right? American Express got kind of hurt when their earnings came out. Capital One got hurt a bit when their earnings came out. And we saw Wells Fargo get hurt. And some of the regionals really got just bashed. I mean, just bashed. So what's going on here? Is there a little bit of a reality happening that, you know what, you can't continue to miss earnings or maybe even beat with just lower revenues and understanding that cost cutting is not going to be the only play, that we're on to you, the banks, that we say, you know what? You know what? We know how you're making money. You better be making a lot more money than that. And your loan provisions, your offsets and your offsets to earnings, or your additions to earnings due to some of the things that have gone on, and the fact that you're, you know, increasing your loan loss provision amounts, that's a real big problem, because we're seeing the numbers get really ugly, really ugly. With that in mind, though, staying away from the banks, where there is one, Hudson City Bancorp that we like. HCBK is something that we like. We talked about that on DH Unplugged at length and talked about all the fundamentals. If you haven't listened to DH Unplugged, go over there and check it out. That's a podcast I do with John Dvorak. And we talked about Hudson quite extensively. We talked about Cintas here recently, didn't we? You made some money on that if you picked that product up there. Uniform company, about up, I think, 5% since we talked about it a week and a half ago. But the real thing I want to look at is what is going on with Amazon, what's going on with Microsoft. Apple seems to be doing great, but these companies are not meeting their expectations. Revenues were down. Microsoft looked absolutely abysmal. There's this interesting situation going on. Dell's not doing well. Microsoft not doing well. Apple's doing well. RIM's not doing well. Apple seems to be maybe taking over the world, and that's quite interesting. I find that to be an interesting situation, this dichotomy, because Apple is not a cheap product. You would have think, just for a moment, you would think that, generally speaking, that the Dells of the world and the HPs of the world, if they're going to be looking at laptops and netbooks, these are the guys that you'd want to buy in a recessionary time. But no, somehow people are buying MacBooks. So what's going on here? I think it's an interesting study of humanity, if you will, and the psychology of people during such a time when they're, you know, questionable about what's going to happen with their job, what the future holds, but yet they're still willing to spend on quality products. I think that's really interesting. I don't mean to go like kind of a little nutty with this, but if you really think about that, that's a really interesting phenomena. What's also interesting is, again, if we get back to the Amazon, I think, well, you know, talk about a company with balls, with cojones. I mean, this is a company that the day their earnings are coming out, they also announced that they're buying Zappos for about $850 million, almost $1 billion. They're buying this online shoe company when they know their earnings are going to be soft. That's a company that is either nuts or very solid or, you know, very sure of themselves. Either way, we know that Amazon's a great, great company, you know, and they've done very well, not only in the book, but in the online retail, if you will. But you know what? It's interesting. Most people thought that, you know, the retailers are going to have a problem. They've been doing very well of late, of course. But you know what? The brick and mortar compared to the online, you know, Amazon has a distinct advantage. Their tax situation is much different than the online, brick and mortars, because they don't have a tax situation. So what's really interesting about them is that they really benefit dramatically. But also, they obviously benefit because they don't have to have the same warehousing for a lot of the products that they sell, the second-tier products. So they get revenue on that. That's not happening in brick and mortar. You know, you don't walk into a Sears and somebody has a little kiosk there and is selling a product, and Sears takes a little bit of a piece of it. What's happening, on the other hand, is that Amazon is collecting from that as well. So when you look at this company and you see that they had an earnings miss, what does that say? What's happening there when so many companies are actually hitting? Google was a little bit short as well. And Microsoft just looked, again, terrible from an earnings and a revenue standpoint. And they don't see any change happening anytime soon. So what's happening here? Well, I think what's happening is very interesting. We had someone on many, many months ago who was a professor that talked about how analysts do in good times and bad times. And in the good times, what they do is they overestimate. They say, you know, things are going to get really good and we think that earnings are going to be this. And oftentimes, companies just don't keep up with that. But in the bad times like we're having now, what companies are doing really well? Well, it's the Caterpillars. It's some of the mining and materials. They have the absolute worst looking growth expectations that you've ever seen, down 68% expectations this quarter. So analysts obviously have just a real negative environment with them. On the other hand, when you look at technology, analysts have a real pretty decent outlook on that. So now what we're seeing is that the materials companies, when they come in, a Caterpillar as an example, are coming in and they're slightly beating. They're low on revenues, but the estimates were so low that they're beating them handily. That's what's happening right now. On the other hand, technology is having a little bit more of a difficult time. Of course, Intel did beat. We saw that really do just tremendous. And, you know, SanDisk came in and got just really hurt. AMD just got killed when they came out with earnings. But, you know, what we're seeing now is this kind of environment that when expectations are achieved or surpassed, and when analysts have such low expectations for the materials and the industrials and the sectors that are kind of the ones that were really a concern, and they missed the boat again, just like they did the second quarter. So while we're all happy that the markets are going up and things are getting much better for people, the fact still remains that what are we going to say about analysts? Do we respect them anymore? Do we really care about what they're saying anymore? And how do we really find any kind of solace in the fact that we're utilizing them and a broad-based grouping of them to estimate what isn't happening in the future? What are they worth anymore? I mean, seriously, what's their worth? Because I'll tell you what's going to happen. When things get better and expectations get better, the analysts are going to be wrong on the upside, causing a big problem. Just this week, Nouriel Roubini came out with, last week he came out with a retraction to something he said, and just this week he came out with his concern, and this is the second person this week, his concern about a double dip recession. Let me tell you how that works. Essentially, what's going to happen, what could happen is that you see this incredible rally. This actually happened back in the 30s, but it's happened a few other times in double dips. But basically what happens is you get a recessionary time period, and there's a lot of money pushed into the system. They clean up the banks, and everything seems okay. But, you know, all of a sudden we see consumers continuing to hold back. You know, we never get past that point of feeling really good about things, and at that point the stimulus is dried up, and things are looking much better. The outlook is good. Confidence is up. But the actual execution of the money flow is not happening. And what happens is that a lot of companies during the time when things were looking better restocked their inventories. They went out to say, hey, you know what? We think things are getting better right now. We kept our inventories very low. We made sure not to do anything that was out of control. We kept our employees low. But what they do is they restock as best they can. They make sure to have their inventories up. That cost them a lot of money. At the same time, they don't really want to put back the employees back to work because, you know what? Until there seems to be a need, until the very last minute, they're not going to keep, you know, any excess costs on the books. In other words, expense ratios they want to keep low. They don't mind restocking, because what happens when they restock is it's inventory. It's an asset, but employees essentially are a liability, and a liability in terms of expense. So what happens is you have an unemployment rate that stays very, very high. Even when you think we're coming out of the recessionary period because all this restocking is happening, what happens is the consumers never pull the trigger, like we were saying. And what that means is that all of a sudden the recession starts to build upon itself again. And then once again, you get companies starting to panic. They may not be firing people right away, but they're definitely not hiring. And then on top of that, what happens is that they don't do any more inventory rebuilds. So we may be into this time period right now that we see that the material stocks and the industrials and things are starting to roll a little bit more, and the factories are starting to pick up a little bit, but they'll slow down as soon as they realize that the end user isn't buying. And in buying, what I mean, and really buying. So this double-dip recession potential without an extra stimulus package, et cetera, and waiting to see what happens here because of the amount of money that was spent already. I mean, you know, there was some estimate about, I don't know, $23 trillion of total backstop and stimulus that was pumped into the economy. You know, whatever the number really is right now, it's enormous, however we want to slice it. But the opportunity and the potential to have a double dip is very, very real. Very, very real in the U.S. It's also very real around the rest of the world, because if the consumption doesn't pick up and exports stay as low as they are, what's going to happen is the only thing they're going to have on terms of the exports are possibly the raw materials and maybe some of the minor finished goods in order to keep the inventories up, in order for them to do the restocking of the inventory, as we've talked about. That being the case, we have to be aware and look for the signs. We can't just scoff off and say, oh, it's a one-time or two-time. We got to be very aware of that. That doesn't mean pull your money in and out of the market per se and try to, you know, be very short-term on it. The truth is right now, we are in a recovery pattern right now. That doesn't mean that we're being bullish, but we're in we're in a recovery pattern right now. Okay, we have stimulus going in, we have jobs that are being lost, and right now we're off the trough, off the bottom, and, you know, generally speaking, we're on a recovery pattern. That, again, doesn't mean you need to be off guard. That doesn't mean go back to the buy and hold lazy portfolio, fall asleep at the wheel, and just, you know, put things in mutual funds. That's not what that means right now. What that means is being in the right sectors that make sense, and riding them as long as you can, protecting yourselves, whether using puts or maybe some ETFs on the short side, when it makes sense to do so. Clearly, let the winners run, as we would hear from Jesse Livermore. Let the winners run and cut your losers really quickly. Simple, very eloquent, but that's the way to play. So, with that, we're going to cut it short today. I think I told you everything you need to know. If you haven't picked up the book, The Disciplined Investor, Essential Strategies for Success, that's kind of the entry fee here, gang. Go pick that up. Go over to Amazon. It's like $13.50. Great quick read, but you'll learn a lot. You'll understand what's going on, and I encourage you to do so because, you know, it's everything that we talk about here, and I'm sure you'll enjoy it. I'm sure that every single listener out there has not picked up a book. You're getting this thing for free, for goodness sakes. Go pick up a book today at Amazon.com and make sure that you know, you're a disciplined investor, because that's where it's all at right now. And I appreciate the opportunity to be here each and every week. We have lots more coming up, lots more great guests. And the summer is just starting and just heating up. Lots more happening on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. But that's going to be it for episode 119 with Jim Rogers. Make sure to stop by thedisciplinedinvestor.com, the show notes from this episode, to find out more about what we talked about today. Thanks for being here. We'll talk to you real soon. Have a safe and a prosperous week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.